Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Dr. Eric Porter on the show. Dr. Porter is a professor of history, history of consciousness, and critical race and ethnic studies at UC Santa Cruz, where he's also affiliated with the Music and Latin America and Latina/Latino studies departments. He previously taught in American studies at UC Santa Cruz, as well as the University of New Mexico and the University of Nevada, Reno. His research and teaching interests include Black cultural and intellectual history, U.S. cultural history, jazz and improvisation studies, urban studies, and comparative ethnic studies. Among his previous books are two University of California Press publications. First, What Is This Thing Called? Jazz, African American Musicians as Artists, Critics, and Activists, a winner of an American Book Award with the photographer Lewis Watts, and New Orleans Suite, Music and Culture in Transition. The subject of our conversation today is his new book, A People's History of SFO, which is a fascinating look at the complicated history of San Francisco's airport using an ethnic studies lens, an environmental lens, and a labor lens. I know you'll love this conversation. Let's go meet Dr. Eric Porter. You've written a number of books about jazz and cultural change, as well as edited one. You've written a book about W.E.B. Du Bois. Can you talk about the jump to writing about transportation and airports?
Sure. Part of the story is I've long been interested in writing about the Bay Area, where I'm from, where I grew up. I wasn't quite sure what form that would take, but that possible project was in the back of my mind. I did do a book on New Orleans called New Orleans Suite with the photographer Lewis Watts. It consists of his photographs and a few essays by me. That was a kind of urban studies project. So that doing that book got me oriented more towards doing a kind of urban studies project, urban history. So that's part of the story. I've also long been interested in airports as spaces, sites for the beginnings of adventures. Also, they're very alienating sites. I've also long thought airports tell us something interesting about the places where they're located. Even though there's a lot of conversation about how generic they are and how homogeneous they are and how you can be almost anywhere in the world when you're in an airport, given the similarity of design and the cultural and social practices that go on there. But it's occurred to me that through the artwork, through the locally oriented cuisine, by virtue of who works service jobs at airports, what recent immigrant population, what marginalized minority population does that kind of work, that often says something about where they're located. I have a family history associated with the airport. My grandfather was a skycap at SFO, and it was that job that brought his side, my father's side of the family, to the Bay Area as part of the Great Migration, Second Great Migration in the 1940s. Again, an interest in doing this something on the Bay Area, interest in doing an urban studies project, interest in airports kind of led to it all coming together. I can't quite pinpoint a particular moment when I decided to do it, but it all made sense.
Yeah, it seems like a microcosm of the Bay Area in general, like you talk about in the book. And so it really, it could be a launching point for a number of discussions about any number of topics via the airport. One interesting thing I noted in your introduction was the connection with your last name and airports, with the Porter as your last name. Can you talk about that for a second?
My grandfather being a skycap, in a sense, the skycaps are basically the people for much of the history of airports, Black men who met customers, fly passengers at the curb and carried their baggage inside was a kind of porter job, porter being the job description that on some level followed the work that Black men were doing on railroad cars, railroad passenger cars, when those were the primary vehicle for long distance transportation. The last name doesn't have anything to do with that occupation, but there is a kind of coincidence there.
Yeah. I know that typically publishers and marketing departments play a large role in titling books, but it feels like your book is titled very specifically to your task. Can you talk about the relationship between what you're doing in your book and the work famously of Howard Zinn? Is it on a similar track in your mind?
On some level, I will say, back to what you just said, that the press had a role in choosing the title, a not insignificant role in choosing the title, but I thought it worked well. A lot of work about airports or about the infrastructure or about have to do with the airlines as they use airports. And you know, this was a study that looks at the way a lot of different people interact with the airport and how the airport facilitates a lot of relationships among different people, often unequal, asymmetrical relationships among different people. And I guess in terms of the political project of the book, it's an investigation of how imperial colonial processes shape people's lives, how racial capitalism shapes people's lives, how people negotiate the systems of power in which they're enmeshed, and how that shapes how they interact with one another.
You already touched on this a little bit, but airports in some ways are confusing because they feel like a bunch of different places stuffed together. A while ago, I was listening to an interview with Henry Graybar, who wrote a book called Paved Paradise. It's about parking and how it influences the development of the United States. And he had this one-off line in the interview where he said essentially something to the effect of that airports are essentially parking lots or very expensive parking lots attached to a terminal. For you, and then secondarily, I was listening to another interview with an airport director, and they described an airport kind of functioning like a city, and him viewing himself as an urban planner. And so you have all these kind of different perspectives on what an airport is. For you, what is an airport, if you were to define it?
It's lots of different things. I don't know about the parking lot. They have parking lots, and parking lots are critical to their operations, but I don't know about that. There's certainly a lot of commentary about airports as cities are operating like cities in terms of the array of work that's done there, in terms of the array of apartments and offices that allow them to function. The way I talked about the airport, which is a way people sometimes talk about cities, is as an assemblage, basically as a system of networks that come together to create a kind of infrastructure that's a kind of node, an interface where lots of different processes and networks come together, which in turn shapes other processes and networks. So for me, that's the way I see it. So vis-a-vis, when I talk about SFO as an assemblage, I talk about it as a focal point for a lot of different processes and systems that not only help to produce this one infrastructure, but also help to make the Bay Area and help to connect the Bay Area to other places as well.
Let's talk about source material before we jump into the meat of the book. In reviewing your bibliography and the notes at the end of your book, it seems like you had to draw on a lot of different places in order to compile this story. And given the number of stakeholders, the fact that the city operated the airport, it seems like it was a complicated process to piece the story together. Can you talk a little bit about some of the challenges and opportunities that you had in looking at the source material?
You're right that it was a challenge to identify sources and pull them together. And there were certainly lots of other sources I could have looked at that I never had a chance to look at. Part of the challenge was that you have the city that operates it. You have lots of different entities, airlines, labor unions that are connected to the airport that do work there. There are state government regulations that shape airport operations. So there are documents available there. There are lots of, getting back to people's history, there are lots of prosaic ways that individuals interact with airports, travelers, activists, just tried to cast a wide net and follow different threads as I learned about issues I decided to talk about, and drew a lot on local journalistic coverage of airport operations, and that was useful, and local archives as well.
How cooperative was the city of San Francisco as you were conducting this research in terms of being forthright with source materials and giving you access to things that you wanted to research?
City of San Francisco, a lot of the materials that were relevant to the study, for example, airport commission documents, other municipal organization documents, the Human Rights Commission that oversaw and tried to implement the affirmative action programs at the airport, for example. A lot of that stuff is just readily available vis-a-vis the San Francisco Public Library. Mm-hmm. And luckily for me, because I sort of ended the research for this book during the early period of the COVID pandemic, a lot of those documents have been digitized. So they were easily accessible. I did do some research at the airport. As you may be aware, SFO has this really important public arts program and a really important museum program. And the museum program not only is responsible for a lot of the curated exhibits that have been installed around the airport over the last 40 years or so, but they also maintain an archive, a publicly accessible archive on the airport's history and airport operations, and researchers can go and visit there, and the archivists there were very helpful.
I don't think I've ever seen them. Where is the museum located in the airport?
So it's in the international terminal, and if you walk in the doors of the international terminal and go to the right side, tucked away, it's behind one set of this security gates, is the museum. And the space of it, or the public-facing space of it, is a reproduction of the old terminal from the 1930s, sort of scaled down, but the design elements are based on that terminal. So they have a room there where they usually have some kind of exhibits. I think some are permanent. When I was last there, there were a whole series of different kinds of aircraft, that the history of aviation vis-a-vis aircraft, models of these different planes across the space. And I think they change out. They have temporary exhibits there too. There's also a reading room in the space too. So if you were to show up at the airport and found out your flight was delayed by 5 hours or something, you could hang out there and read before you go through security. But then in the back, there's the collection, researchers and archivists that work there. And they do a number of things there. They house materials, curate them, that they, I think, are provided. They have old construction documents and the like that are relevant when there's a construction project of some kind at the airport, and they have space and materials for researchers. I think some of it's relevant to the curated exhibits that are displayed across the airport. There's also a web presence too. I mean, one can go to the SFO Museum website and they will have information there. I think that some of that information that eventually gets digitized is stored in the space.
Yeah, I spent some time perusing the site. It's pretty thorough. They've got their collections. They've got a bunch of the resources that they have available. I've never gone right when I've gone in the terminal. I'm always going straight as fast as I can. So maybe next time I'm there, I need to make a right and check it out.
It's worth a visit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's jump into the first chapter of the book. You spend a lot of time in that chapter tracing the history of colonialism, dispossession, the effects of capitalist formation and development. Why did you feel it was important to really dig into that subject before jumping into SFO? Because in the first chapters, there's a lot of setup and a lot of backstory to the history of the conquering and development of California. Why did you feel like it was important to start there?
I wanted to make this a history of the Bay Area as well as the airport, right? It's about how the airport helped to facilitate some of the transformations that made the Bay Area political, economic, social, but it's also how the airport was a manifestation of some of these broad scale historical transformations. This is a history of the Bay Area. I wanted to capture some of that earlier Bay Area history that shaped the 20th century, kind of the foundation of the 20th century relationships that were central to the creation of the airport and which the airport helped to facilitate. Yeah, I was also interested in responding to doing something a little different than some of the narratives that one often sees. The origin point for SFO. Often the histories of SFO began with the land on which it was built. And when some of the histories that the airport has produced itself, some of the journalistic coverage that gives a sense of the history of SFO. The airport was built on this reclaimed salt marsh in San Mateo County that was first leased and then sold to the city of San Francisco by the wealthy Mills family. And this is by the descendants of Darius Ogden Mills, who was a wealthy California banker who made a fortune financing gold and silver mining in the Sierras, and then through another investments was one of the principals of the Bank of California, which itself made a huge amount of generated a huge amount of capital financing silver mining and other things that was central to the economic political development of the Bay Area. So given the interest in telling this story about how the histories of colonialism and imperialism shaped the Bay Area, knowing that there was this connection with this wealthy banking family, I just decided to take the story back earlier, vis-a-vis this piece of land, and talk about how different people had related to it. Were in the case of the Ramaytush Ohlone, people were dispossessed from it. Other people who had worked this land, been exploited about this on this land, generated reasonable lives for themselves by working on this site or near this site, and how this anticipated some of the 20th century stories that I told.
It seems in line with a lot of broader patterns in California history, the kind of the twin relationship of conquering and then exclusion that comes soon after, once the wealth generated is really discovered what is available to take, and then it's quickly decided who gets to take it and who gets to have access. So in that first chapter, initially when I read it, I wasn't sure exactly the connection, but then the more I thought about it, I thought, oh, he's drawing it into a broader story of broader patterns in California. That SFO is just a microcosm of, and that we can see and connect to the bigger story of the state.
That's what I was essentially doing. Yeah, that's a more concise way of putting what I just said.
Let's talk about who was there first. My understanding is that the Ohlone didn't live in the exact land that SFO is now situated on, partly because that was basically swamp and marsh, but it was an area where there was a lot of hunting, scavenging, and gathering. Can you talk about the land prior to development, the environment, the ecosystem that was there before we had these big concrete tarmacs slapped down on top of that landfill that we pushed in there?
Yeah, so again, the airport was built on salt marsh. So this was part of the tidelands, sometimes dry, sometimes swampy, sometimes inundated, depending on what the tides were doing at a particular time. There's open water to the east of it and dry land to the west of it. So yeah, the Ohlone people who lived in a series of villages on dry land, northeast, northwest, and south. Or southwest of the airport did use the land for hunting, fishing, foraging, aquatic plants, marsh plants, whether for food or they harvested tule reeds to make housing and the like. And yeah, it was just part of the California ecosystem that was then transformed long before, radically transformed long before the airport was built. It was after the Ohlone were displaced. Many of them were essentially enslaved and brought to Mission Dolores in San Francisco. The land was then transformed to Mission and the Presidio, the military outpost, Spanish military outpost in San Francisco, grazed cattle around the land in the foothills and above the marshland, and the cows would sometimes go into the marshland to eat plants, so that radically transformed it. And then a California rancher, Jose Antonio Sanchez, then was able to get the land from the mission, and he grazed cattle on it as well. And then Mills got hold of the land, was part of this group of wealthy Anglos who were able to get through various means, sometimes through lawful purchase, sometimes through less legal means, able to get hold of, obtain California holdings, and he, other wealthy land, Anglo or Anglo landholders in San Mateo County, built an estate there. And then he, in addition to being a wealthy banker, was also a gentleman farmer. So he raised cattle and he hired Chinese laborers and wasn't quite able to figure this out, but it's likely that he, that the laborers, Chinese laborers that he hired to basically build a levee around the salt marsh and reclaim it into dry land, some of them may have been part of the labor force that did a lot of reclamation work in the Central Valley in the years, at that, you know, in the 1860s, 1870s. And some of them may also have been railroad workers as well. So anyway, he was able to transform that land into essentially dry land so he could graze his dairy cows on it. And that was basically the state of it before it was, after he passed away, his family still held on to a significant part of the mill's estate. And that was essentially what the land was like before his family leased it and then sold it to the city of San Francisco to build the airport.
It seems to me, based on what I've been reading in newspaper environmental coverage of the area, that the sea is trying to reclaim SFO. I've been reading about tarmac sinking, runways sinking. There's that very expensive shoreline program that SFO is trying to roll out to protect its future. What's your perception on how SFO is handling the environmental challenges of climate change and the instability of parts of the airport?
Yeah, it's going to be a challenge. I'll say that. It's interesting. It's an interesting story. This is something I address in the final chapter of the book. SFO has tried to be, as much as I think they can, as a airport, which generates a lot of fossil fuel emissions and produces a lot of various kinds of pollution. They've tried to be a reasonable environmental steward. So they've been engaged in are on one hand a lot of pretty interesting sustainability projects over the last few decades to try to address some of the, try to mitigate some of its effects on the environment. But it's there's only so much they can do, right? Yeah. In terms of, they can have done a great job in cutting carbon emission in airport operations beyond what aircraft do, right? But that those savings are minuscule compared to the carbon emissions generated by aircraft that are using the airport as they fly between SFO and other airports. Some of their sustainability efforts involve trying to protect it from climate change. And they have plans to build this through this, I think it's called the Shoreline Protection Plan. They have plans to build this seawall. Whether that will be effective or not remains to be seen. And they have to secure all the funding for it. And then so much depends on what sea level rise looks like. If it's 3 feet before 2100, maybe it'll be okay. If it's 10 feet, it won't be okay. A lot of things won't be okay. And I think there are some also challenges vis-a-vis its neighbors too. There's a lot of the work that I've read about sea level rise mitigation discusses the fact that if things aren't coordinated very carefully, what one entity, whether it's an air or Caltrans, when it comes to protecting Bay Area freeways, if their efforts aren't coordinated really well with those of other entities, then those protection projects can just shift seawater elsewhere and make things more dire for those entities that perhaps don't have things in place or don't have adequate funding to do as good a job protecting their own resources. So I know that some of the communities surrounding us or near SFO are worried that what SFO does to protect its runways might have a very negative, harmful effect on those cities. Low-lying places like Millbrae, for example.
That sounds like a number of spinning plates and the definition of trade-offs and opportunity costs when you're making any kind of decision, but you also can't anticipate the way the environment will respond. Let's jump into talking a little bit about the military. The military has played a large role in the development of some of the largest metropolitan areas in California through ports, manufacturing, related industries. Can you discuss the relationship between the military and the development of SFO?
Yeah, I think the first thing to say is that civilian aviation really was developed on a foundation started by the military, or that was, initiated by the military. Early aviation, going back to the 19 air routes were the commercial air routes followed those established by the military. Pilots were typically trained by the military. The story goes on from there. As civilian air aviation came into its own during the 1930s and 1940s, some of the justification for putting federal funding into airport development, it was justified because on the grounds that civilian airports could also serve a civilian defense function as well during times of war. It could be sites for troop transport, moving munitions and the like from point A to point B. SFO benefited directly from a lot of government subsidy on those along those lines, justified by the military function it could serve. Also, it's a long story. I'll try to be brief. During the late 30s, very beginning of the 1940s, San Francisco developed a second airport on Treasure Island that coincided with the building, the creation of Treasure Island in the middle of the bay, and the development of the world's site of the World's Fair there. And at one point, there was some uncertainty as to whether that site or the San Mateo County site would be the primary airport. What ends up happening is that the military gets access to the Treasure Island site at the beginning of World War, and then with the expectation that it would return the site to San Francisco, but then ends up appropriating it. And in exchange for that, or some complicated politicking, ends up making some substantial improvements to the San Mateo County site, which it was also using for troop transport and the like during World War II. But the improvements that the military, both the Army and the Navy, do to the San Mateo County site actually end up expanding the what becomes a fully civilian airport after the war quite substantially. And there's other elements to the story too. So much of the aircraft technology that civilian airports use, so many of the planes that civilian airports, that airlines use, are based on military planes, either that are military planes that have been, or the aircraft that originate as military planes and then are either the particular planes are repurposed or the manufacturers use a basic design for a military plane and then make modifications as they develop civilian aircraft. Yeah, it's at some level, what I talk about is SFO as a kind of corollary to this broader story of how militarism played a significant role in the development of the Bay Area in terms of its industrial infrastructure, as well as in terms of bringing lots of different people to the region. A story that's, I think, more familiar known through the establishment of the shipbuilding industry and the massive expansion of that during World War II and the establishment of naval bases, army bases, and aircraft, Air Force bases around the Bay Area.
Yeah, I thought your book was a great complement to a lot of the work that's done on Bayview, Hunter's Point, and how the development there and the development further south. You touched on something I want to dig into for a second, but from more of an economic, regional, civilian perspective. Obviously, the Bay Area of 1926, when voters voted to approve the purchase of the land for the airport, is very different from the Bay Area today. Can you briefly talk about what the planners and the boosters for the airport envisioned what SFO would do for the region?
So early on, when the airport was first established in the 90s, at that point, civilian air industry was based on transporting airmail more so than transporting people. There's some money to be made there, but there's a sense that that can grow. That as there's a sense that the air industry will help to develop international trade that will benefit the region. So that region, the Bay Area as a region. So that's what a lot of civilian boosters were focused on in the 1920s, to expand the Bay Area's sense its commercial imperial reach. And they also thought it would be symbolically important for there to be a significant airport there and also for the Bay Area to hold on to its role as the western terminus of the domestic airmail route and try to keep that away from Los Angeles, because there's a lot of competition between the Bay Area and LA over at that point in time as to which is going to be the major California metropolitan region. So that's what people had in mind. And at that point, there wasn't so much attention to the airport as a generator, as a generator of local jobs, but that then becomes a major part of the story during and after World War II. There's just increasingly a sense that airport itself can be an economic engine because of the amount of jobs created there and the spending that will happen in surrounding the communities, as opposed to just being a site for facilitating trade.
Let's transition here to probably my favorite chapter in the book, which is A Black Future in the Air Industry. In part because I feel like in that chapter, I learned so much because there's such a large confluence of forces at work in expanding economic opportunities for Black employees and SFO. And I think what was most interesting to me in the chapter was the role that activism played. You hear a lot about civil rights legislation changing things in various industries. But I hear less the stories of individual people or union contingents advocating for changes. So, can you talk about the role that activism played in fighting discrimination and increasing opportunities for African Americans working in the airport?
The air industry was notoriously discriminatory for its first several decades of operation, and with the exception of some low-paid service work and some well-paying service work like skycapping, very few African Americans worked at SFO until the around 1960. And that was in part because of discrimination. It was also in part because of there wasn't a lot of attention by activists. Our activist attention wasn't directed to the airport. There was a sense that the discrimination was so entrenched there, it'd be hard to dislodge, and that there were other opportunities elsewhere that might bear fruit more easily in terms of just getting access to better paying jobs for Black people in the Bay Area. But then things started to change as the airport started to employ more people in general, and in part because of some activism that was happening in the Midwest and on the East Coast, particularly on behalf of African American flight attendants to desegregate that occupation, local activists began to look more at SFO as a potential site for getting access to more better opportunity, getting access to opportunity. From that moment on is a fair amount of activism by local civil rights, local branches of civil rights organizations like the NAACP and the Urban League to open up, putting pressure on airlines, putting pressure on labor unions to open up opportunities for African American employees, and also putting pressure on the city of San Francisco to do more to fight discrimination at this facility that it controlled. Local activists like Willie Brown, who's assemblyman at the time, Carlton Goodlett, publisher of the Sun Reporter, prominent San Francisco physician and an activist, put pressure on the city to open up opportunities. They were successful in getting the San Francisco Human Rights Commission to start to institute some affirmative action programming that put more pressure on airlines to and different concessions to do some work to open up opportunities and hire more Black people in more better paying positions, more prestigious positions. But it's a long, complicated story.
Yeah, would you say it was this program with all these different stakeholders was successful? Would you call it a success?
Partially. Partially, yeah. I think like a lot of efforts to open up Black employment and to counter discrimination was partially successful. If you look at the numbers over time, things do improve pretty dramatically from, say, the early 60s to through the 1970s, not only in terms of Black employment, but also in terms of African American small business owners getting access to either being able to create concessions that do business at the airports, or to getting access to construction contracts and the like. But success is with some limits. Ultimately, the numbers, it's the city of San Francisco back before Bakke, where people could try to achieve certain quotas that were based on the representation of different populations in the broader Bay Area population. They never quite hit certain numbers. And then during the post-Bakke, when affirmative action programs were more limited, as you see other things happen in the airline industry, like deregulation, that in which certain well-paying jobs disappear, and there's in part because of things like airlines, rather than paying their own employees reasonably well, end up getting certain services through contractors that hire less well-paid labor, then some of the gains that are made are diminished.
Yeah. Let's take a step back and take a kind of a, no pun intended, 20,000 foot perspective on your work. And I have some broader questions. There's so much more we can dig into. I really loved the chapter on jet noise as well, and the kind of the politics of noise, if you will. I thought that was fascinating. But I think what I want to end with here is discussing some of the implications of your book. How do you think your book is going to add to the conversation? And what will it add to the conversation about how the Bay Area developed and how we should think about the legacy of the Bay Area's development?
One thing I want people to think about is the role of infrastructure in Bay Area history, how one could look at other things too, like the freeway system or military bases. And people have done that on the Bay Area and other regions. But to look at how these infrastructures not only play a role in shaping the historical development of the Bay Area in particular, but offer interesting windows into the history. Let us think about other processes that have broader ramifications. One of the themes in the book is the ways that Bay Area history is shaped by interactions among a lot of differently situated people, that imperial processes, colonial processes, various kinds of political processes bring people together in asymmetrical ways, and we generate transformation through these often fraught interactions with one another. So I think that the airport as a site where not only where a physical site where people come together, but as a site that generates politics where people come together. For example, lots of differently situated people come together. For example, at city council meetings in surrounding communities where people, aggrieved neighbors and local business owners and airport officials and representatives of labor unions got together to argue about whether airport operations were okay as they are or were, or whether they needed to be scaled back because of the noise they produced, and to try to ameliorate some of the noise that they produced. And different people had a stake in whether when maintaining operations as usual, expanding them or scaling them back. And I think you see the airport as a generator of those issues, a generator of those issues brought people together in interesting ways. And I think that's something I'd like people to think about vis-a-vis Bay Area history, how it's shaped by these interesting fraught asymmetrical relationships. Another thing I spent a lot of time talking about in the book is how the Bay Area is a place that we often think about as a site for the where very important liberal and progressive politics have been generated and enacted. And one of the things I explore there in the jet noise chapter, or in the chapter about how SFO generated a lot of politics around immigration and US immigration policy, that a lot of well-meaning progressive projects often had their contradictions, right? And were successful to some degree in addressing the issues that were facing some members of the Bay Area, some Bay Area residents, but often didn't take into consideration the needs of other populations, or might have produced changes, new policies that were still exclusionary towards them. And that's something, that's a theme that comes up again and again in the book.
How has your perspective on the history of California changed conducting this research?
I learned a lot more about California history, for one thing. Like I said at the beginning, I wanted to do, I'm from the Bay Area, I knew something about its history. There was a lot I didn't know and still don't know. And this was just, it provided an opportunity to learn more about the role of militarism in shaping the Bay Area. I'm very much a 20th century, mid-20th and late 20th century historian. So it allowed me to dig into some 19th century history, which I knew very little about. I just knew, had a thumbnail sketch version of the history of California missions and history of indigenous communities in and around the Bay Area. So it allowed me to just learn more about certain issues that I just had a very basic knowledge of.
And when you walk into any airport, not necessarily SFO, has this book changed the way you see just airports in general? Are you looking at certain things? Are you noticing certain things because you've dug into this research about this one particular airport so deeply?
That's a good question. I think one way it has, and I'm going to answer this question by also sort of saying something more in response to your previous question, which is that one thing that I hope people will take away from the book is that, and one way I think it intervenes in the conversation about airports is that they are really interesting reflections of where they're located. And there is this conversation about, and this dialogue assumption about airports is very homogeneous and not really, and reflection of the kind of homogenization of culture and sociability really globally. And I'd like people to think about how airports, whether they're major metro international airports like SFO or even small regional airports, really are interesting reflections of the places where they're located. Following that, I had noticed the arts program at SFO before, and it's a really amazing arts program. SFO's won awards. The SFO Museum, I think, is the first airport museum to be accredited by one of the prominent organizations that accredits museums. And the learning more about the public art program, the history of it, how it came to be, about and the museum exhibits around the airport, yeah, it makes me just think about more about what other airports are doing at the level of art and design to speak about where they are, and to think about what the politics behind some of that exhibition might be. How are they trying to get travelers and even local people who are using the airport to fly in and out of, how are these airports designed to get people to think differently about the places where they're situated? How do they promote a sense of regional identity? Things like that. So I guess I'm a little more attuned to that as I go, as I fly in and out of airports, assuming I have time to reflect.
Yeah, and usually you're just rushing, right?
Yeah, rushing to get a flight or trying to get out to catch the last shuttle or something like that.
We always conclude these conversations in the same place, which is with book recommendations. What are a few books either on this subject or subjects that interest you that you'd recommend to the audience?
Oh, there's so many.
Go as much as you want. I'm a librarian, so this is just,
yeah,
you know,
okay.
This is my catnip.
Okay, we talked a little bit about the Black Labor chapter, and I mentioned briefly that activists in the Bay Area were inspired by some of the work done elsewhere. Some of the activism elsewhere that was trying to desegregate employment in certain airline or air industry occupations in other parts of the country. A great book that's about African-American activism in the transportation industry more generally is Mia Bay's Traveling Black, which looks not only at the air industry, but at cars and buses and the railroad and other forms of transportation as well. There's a book called Jim Crow Terminals by Anke Ortlep, which looks at Black activism that's in Southern airports in the Southern United States, where the challenge was not just to get access to different kinds of employment, but also to challenge Jim Crow in the terminals themselves. Because as we all know from the history of the civil rights movement, there were streetcars and buses, railroad cars, and terminals, bus stations, railroad terminals were segregated as well. So that part of it, there was an effort to desegregate airport terminals as well in the South. Oh, there's, I don't know, we've mentioned but didn't really talk too much about jet noise. There's this great book about the politics of jet noise in and around LAX, Los Angeles's airport, not only how jet noise has influenced the environment, but also how people have responded to it. And that's by Marina Peterson, who's an anthropologist, and that book is called Atmospheric Noise. So that's another interesting book. We've touched on the Cold War and empire a little bit, internationalism. There's a book by Jennifer Van Vleck, V-L-E-C-K, which is called Empire of the Air, which is about the development of the air industry and how that developed hand in hand with U.S. imperialism. She spends a lot of time talking about Pan American Airlines, now defunct, but which was one of the major players in the early mid 20th century, and their history. The Pan Am officials were constantly in dialogue with the U.S. military and U.S. government, U.S. State Department, to coordinate efforts to expand Pan Am routes and access to different parts of the world that went hand in hand with the military and State Department's efforts to do the same thing. It's a really interesting book. It talks a lot about the Cold War. There's some great books about flight attendants. Phil Tenmeyer's Playing Queer, which looks at LGBTQ flight attendants. Kathleen Barry's Femininity in Flight, which focuses on women and some of the women flight attendants and how their activism was shaped by feminist, second wave feminist movement. I can go on and on.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great starting place. My last question for you, though, is what are you working on next?
Good question. Still coming together. I'm taking some initial steps into a project that's going to move in yet another direction, which is it's going to be an investigation of how Black intellectuals, activists were thinking about ecology in the and African Americans' relationship with the land as workers, as farmers, who are workers, of course, in the late 19th and early 20th century, when relationship with the land was often quite exploitative. But I'm also interested in the ways that people were thinking about other less exploitative, perhaps liberatory ways of working with thinking about the land. Just getting started with that one.
Fantastic. Dr. Porter, this has been a real pleasure. Again, the book is called A People's History of SFO, The Making of the Bay Area and an Airport. It is a fantastic read. Pick it up from your local bookshop. We just barely scratched the surface with a lot of the amazing details that are covered in this book. We didn't get a chance to talk about a number of the chapters, in part because I want everyone to read it, because really digging into the details is where the fun is. So, Dr. Porter, thanks again for talking with us, and I hope everyone picks up a copy of the book.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to speak with you. And I really do hope that folks will pick up the book.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time. Thank you.